Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled The 2008 Subprime Mortgage Crisis. Recorded in 2008, Dennis McQuistion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, speaks with a panel of finance and banking professionals about the credit and subprime mortgage crisis and their predictions about a recession or a depression. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Do you remember the hundreds of banks and savings and loans that closed in the 1980s? Do you remember the devastation that it caused for individual consumers of financial products and for jobs and corporate profits? Well, if you do, then you have a better understanding of the backdrop for today's credit crunch. In the past few months, a worldwide disruption of financial markets has occurred, apparently driven by several factors, including a proliferation of subprime lending by certain financial institutions in America. We're going to examine what caused this crunch, how deep the problem might be, and most importantly, how it might affect you as a homeowner or renter or investor in American real estate. Now, assuming that your television set in your home won't be foreclosed before this program is over, sit back and let's meet the experts. Starting on my right is Mike Davis. He teaches economics and finance at Southern Methodist University's Cox School of Business. Mike, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
That's my alma mater, so it's a great place. Hang in there. Sitting next to you is Dory Wiley, president of Commerce Street Capital, portfolio manager of several investment funds. He's a CPA, a member of the Board of Trustees of the Teacher Retirement System of Texas, and that's a $100 billion pension fund where he's chairman of the Alternative and Assets Committee. Dory, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great
MBA to be here. MBA from SMU, too, as I recall, right?
That's correct.
We don't mention any other colleges. Oh, we do, too. Bob McTeer is a distinguished fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis. He's the former chancellor of the Texas A&M University System. He's an economist by education and training, 36 years with the Fed, including 14 as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dennis.
And last but certainly not least, John Heasley, executive vice president, a lawyer, I might point out, general counsel of the esteemed Texas Bankers Association. John, I start with you. What the heck is the credit crunch? Tell that viewer.
There's currently a credit crunch in the mortgage markets. And the persons, any individual right now is looking to get a mortgage is going to find out that the terms and accessibility of that compared to 4 or 5 months ago are radically different. This is caused by what's been described as a subprime contagion, which essentially is over $100 billion in mortgages that have been sold into the secondary markets, securitized and bought by investors. And now many of those loans are going bad. And as a result, there's a lack of liquidity, there's an uncertainty associated with it, and that in turn falls upon the homeowners and the people wanting to buy
things. No question. Now, Bob, some people are blaming this on your former boss and the former head of the Fed, Alan Greenspan. Tell us it isn't true.
It's not true, Dennis. A lot of people do think that the fact that interest rates went down so far in 2003, they got down to 1% on the Fed controls, and stayed down a while, contributed to this by making people more prone to take risks. They wanted a higher return. They couldn't get a higher safe return, so they were willing to take on more risk. And somehow or another, they failed to take into account that it might not work out for them.
Well, exactly. I want to show you this graphic right now. This is graphic number 9. This is what the Fed policy did. And so while that graphic is up there, Bob, give us just a little history, because you were with the Fed during most of these years. Tell us what this was all about and why those rates were lowered so dramatically and kept there for so long.
Well, the beginning of the lowering was right after 9/11, 2001. And in 2002, the recovery started, but it was very sluggish. You may remember we were calling it the jobless recovery. And as we moved into 2003, it still was sluggish, and the inflation rate was coming down very rapidly. Chairman Greenspan thought there was a danger that we might actually go from disinflation to deflation, that is, where prices would actually fall, as they had been doing in Japan. And the Japan example indicated that once that starts, it's hard to stop. So he wanted to take out an insurance policy against that happening by making rates very low and making the economy certainly stay out of any kind of deflation.
Well, it certainly did that. Now, Dory, do you have any problem with the Fed's issues here or not, from your perspective?
Really, I don't. I think the Fed's done a pretty good job. They can only control so much. You know, they can't underwrite credit. And we've got a credit problem here. Credit's work in cycles. In 2000, for example, I felt like the recession there was fairly light because banks and the markets did a very good job underwriting credit. We had a few problems in the syndicated area, but overall banks had done a good job, and for the most part they had a pretty good memory from what happened, 10, 15 years before. This time, I think some of that memory's been gone, and it's fairly aggressive, and it's really showed up in the capital market structure.
Sector. Before you get to the capital markets, let me show you graphic number 8. Okay. And on graphic number 8, you're going to see an incredible increase over the last 10, 12 years in something called subprime mortgage-backed securities. Try to explain that in words of one syllable that I and my viewer can understand.
Basically, it's bad credit, to be honest with you. And the markets, capital markets, have gotten very aggressive underwriting that. If you had another year there, there's about $553 billion of subprime credit that went out and into structured finance in the capital markets.
All right, now let me ask you about, well, we all know what capital markets is, and maybe a person that does not know that. When you say capital markets, explain precisely how this works.
Rather than a bank underwriting this loan and keeping it on its balance sheet, it's sold off into the market, into the capital markets. And the capital markets take it and structure it and dice it up, and they create things called collateralized debt obligations. It's a $1 trillion market. It's a very big market. Over half of it is subprime.
Subprime, okay. Meaning people who normally might not qualify to do this borrowing. Is that right, John?
Subprime was essentially brought about 2 decades ago to help people who would normally qualify for home ownership get into a home. You're pricing their risk. They might have a bad credit history or no credit history. And for the most part, it's done well. What has happened is a few things have gotten out of control in the last few years.
Exactly. Now, as you're in your committee with the TRS, did you see any of these things that you had the opportunity to invest in, Dory?
Actually, we saw those, and we turned down, for example, a couple of the Bear Stearns hedge funds that went under. I was very familiar with those, had known them intimately and knew the portfolio managers. But the quote that I'd given them was that you can take this bad credit and you can dress it up with a CDO, but it's still a pig.
if it looks like a pig and all
it's
that.
It's still a pig.
It's definitely a pig.
CDOs are great structures, but they can't fix bad credit.
Exactly. Now, Mike, you've sort of got an academic approach to this thing. Give us some perspective here from your point.
Well, it's careful. We need to be careful not to get overwrought with the current circumstances. The subprime market is a good thing. I think we've already said that there are people out there who, if you give them the right kind of deal, they can get in and become homeowners. It's also, securitization is a good idea. It provides liquidity into the market. Those were all positive developments. The excesses are what we need to worry about.
Exactly. When you say excesses, that means it's just too much of it, or are we talking about some fraud here? What are we talking about?
Well, the fraud for sure, and I think you may have other panelists who have better war stories than I do as far as that goes, but clearly there was fraud, there was bad practices on both the borrower and lender side.
Yeah, underwriting. John?
Underwriting decisions got very lax. There were people were getting loans that were called ninja loans. No income, no jobs, no assets. People were signing notes that they couldn't repay. Mortgage brokers were steering people toward financing that wasn't in their best interest. The rating agencies, the Standard & Poor's, would look at a big collection of securities and say they're AAA rated, even though they had embedded losses within. There's blame to go all the way around.
Now, what's a rating agency, Bob? Tell that viewer what a rating agency is if they don't know what it is.
Well, it's an agency that I've just been learning has been working with the industry primarily to put a credit rating on there that's supposed to be a seal of good approval or seal of semi-good approval so that the public can go on that and not have to do research on its own. It turns out that hasn't worked very well.
Yeah. Dory?
Well, for example, 47% of net income last year from Moody's came directly from collateralized debt obligations in rating those debt obligations. So you sort of have a conflict of interest.
Dory, they say, they're in the Wall Street Journal saying that they're not culpable in this thing. They did not let these fees influence their decision. Isn't that right?
That's what they say, but you got to consider the source.
Well, let me consider a graphic number 7. I want to look at that right now. I want to show you what has happened over the past few years since 1971. This is the ratio of median housing price over median family income. And what it means is that we have a whole lot more people buying a whole lot more house than they can afford. Mike, is that one of those problems you're talking about?
That's a problem. Some of what you're seeing there is people essentially buying a lottery ticket with a bad check. They're getting into a house that they can't afford in hopes that the prices will keep on going and then they'll be able to bail out.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that
way.
It's
kind of like musical chairs, wasn't it, Dory? You know, who's going to have the house when the music stops playing here?
Absolutely. It's another bubble.
Yeah.
It's another bubble.
Another bubble.
There's an expression, never confuse brilliance with a bull market.
Exactly.
Nothing bad had been happening because prices had kept going up and
exactly.
It hadn't been stress tested.
Exactly. Well, and there are a lot of loan officers who don't have the gray hair that I have. When I was a banker and went through all this stuff back in the 80s, and John, you were around the time. You don't have any gray hair to speak of, but Bob, you were certainly around the time. Dory, you were around the edge of it, I think. And I'm telling you, it was grim. Now, I think you guys are not going to be quite as concerned about it overall, but there's a guy that I met in Las Vegas 90 days ago, and he's an economist as well. His name is Fred Fulvery. He teaches at Santa Clara University out in California. Wrote a little pamphlet, which one of you guys are holding there, called The Depression of 2008. And we're going to run that video and find out why Fred Fulvery says we're going to have a real estate depression very shortly.
I'm forecasting a depression most likely in the year 2008, but certainly by the end of the decade. And that's based on my study of real estate cycles as well as business cycle theory.
Now, a lot of people, a lot of economists today are saying, you know, the economy in America, bad first quarter in 2007, but coming back and looking pretty doggone good. Why would you be so far off the mark compared to what other people are saying?
Yeah, the economy may well rebound after the first quarter, but I'm basing the forecast on economic theory as well as economic history. And most forecasters who don't think there'll be a depression have not studied this theory and they don't know this history. And what I've done is I've combined the Austrian school business cycle theory based on capital goods and interest on money and the Henry George theory of depressions based on land value. And by themselves, both are incomplete, but I've synthesized them together to form a very powerful explanation. And then you go back in history, does this explanation fit with history, and it fits it to a T. And so in my talk and book, I have a real estate cycle chart that go all the way back to the early 1800s. And the history shows that a couple of years after real estate peaks, there has been a major depression. Every major depression has been preceded by a real estate boom. And so if it doesn't happen, it'll be the first time in history that it didn't happen.
Okay, well, these kind of asset bubbles, which some people refer them to, are typically driven by something. What is it that drives the boom before you get to the bust?
Yeah, the boom is driven by two things. One is the money supply, where you have a big expansion of the money supply that drives interest rates down, and you have this artificial stimulus to investment. And secondly, by land speculation, which pushes real estate prices way up above what's affordable to residences and businesses.
Well, I knew there'd be somebody taking a shot at the Fed. I just didn't know who it was. You know, what do you think, Bob?
Well, the money supply grew fast enough to push interest rates down, but it didn't grow fast enough to push inflation up. Inflation during most of the period on your chart there has been fairly mild and declining. But the Austrian economists do have a point, and that is when the government makes interest rates something different than the market would have it be, there are some distortions that take place. And probably one negative distortion that took place by rates being so low was it encouraged people to sort of lose their standards, seeking higher return, higher yield.
All right, I'm looking at graphic number 1, Mike, and then I'm going to ask you to do what you want to about what Fred Fulvery say, but this is a guy named Christopher Wood, and if those of you who read the great book that he wrote about 15-20 years ago about Japan, the bubble economy, Christopher Wood said investors should sell all exposure to the American mortgage securities market. That was from a thing he writes called Greed and Fear. And he wrote that, he said, pretty conventional advice, yes, but he wrote that in October 2005. So 2 years ago, Mike, he predicted this, basically.
Yeah, and good for him. And as you can always look back and say, well, there was this sign and this sign and this sign, and how did we miss it? But it really has been extraordinary, the run-up in housing prices, especially on the coasts, in an environment of fairly low inflation.
Well, you're right about the thing. This asset bubble is a question of little bubbles, isn't it, in different mm-hmm. places. Talk to us about the coast and where the bubbles really are, because Texas is not one of them, as far as I can tell.
No, not really. We've seen, we haven't lost money in housing in most places around here, but we haven't had the big run-up of 12-15% per year for several years in a row, and that may ultimately be save us if there is kind of something of a downturn.
Well, let me show you graphic number 4. This is the former economist. We have a couple of economists here. This is a former economist for the National Association of Realtors, and I'm sure just an absolutely objective person. The most prominent housing booster was David LaRoe, I'm not sure, who was the chief economist at the National Association of Realtors until April of this year. In 2005, he published a book entitled, Are You Missing the Real Estate Boom? This year, he published a new book entitled, All Real Estate is Local. He acknowledged that he had gotten it wrong, saying he did not fully realize how loose lending standards had gotten and how quickly they would tighten up again this summer. And John, he wrote book after book and stuff about pumping up real estate as an example. Now, I don't know about you, but it seems to me that a lot of these real estate folks, mortgage brokers and others, were writing their own terms for the borrowers as opposed to some bank or credit union or savings and loan saying yay, nay, or what?
The market has evolved to where over half of the mortgages originated now are not with banks or savings and loans, and as such are not really supervised adequately. So what you're seeing that has been sold and pushed off was not attributed to bank underwriting. Now, there's 160 businesses in mortgages that are out of business now, and their business is migrating back to your traditional lenders as to how it was.
Well, I think that's an important thing to know. And Dory, you guys do a lot of stuff with banks as well, that mostly the banks and the thrifts and the credit unions didn't do the stupid stuff. It was primarily mortgage companies, or am I wrong about that?
Well, you're right, except don't say the banks aren't affected, because they are. We've got late payments, non-performing assets, delinquent loans. They've increased this last quarter the highest they've at a rate higher than they have in 17 years. So do I think the banks are going to be in trouble? No, but they're going to slow down. The banks have good regulatory prompt and corrective action. They've got lots of capital, and there's an efficient market for getting bad assets off the books.
Most of us in this room end up reading the Wall Street Journal fairly often, and occasionally you read the Wall Street Journal and you find people's names of people you don't know. I mean, Bob had an article on the editorial page recently, and he's done it several times, and I see you guys' names all over the place. But this is a lady named Cheryl Kowalski. Cheryl, I saw your name and saw that you were from Dallas, and I called you up and I said, come down here and tell us what this is all about, please.
Well, I think one of the issues that we haven't addressed yet is the issue of moral hazard. And this is something that has gotten people really upset. Essentially, I think we're in this predicament because we've had a lot of creative financial engineering on the part of the investment bankers and the mortgage bankers. And essentially, Alan Greenspan actually called some of the mortgage lending practices fraud. And my question is, if the Fed is going to jump in and bail out the credit markets at the first sign of a problem, is he not encouraging this reckless, irresponsible behavior and excessive risk-taking in the future?
That's a great question, Cheryl. Thank you. Bob, I give that to you.
that's the reason that the Fed was kind of late to the party on this. They were very reluctant to do anything until it became clear that the credit crunch was severe enough that it threatened the real economy. They were afraid of moral hazard. Let me just say that the key thing that changed is that when banks and SNLs made mortgages and kept them on their books, they didn't want to make a mortgage that the borrower couldn't afford. They wanted it to be paid off. But once most of the mortgages started being made by mortgage brokers who were going to sell them, and they were just doing it for fees, it wasn't going to be their problem. There's where the moral hazard that caused this problem came in, the separation of the person who made the loan and the people who would lose money if it went bad.
Mike.
But you're absolutely right, but we have to be careful here because the ability to resell a loan provided an awful lot of liquidity into that market, which was a good thing. And so I don't think any of us here would want to go back to 1978, where savings and loans originated most of the home mortgage loans, and they had, you know, long-term assets and short-term liabilities. That was a mess.
That was. Dory.
Well, the market was fine until, I hate to say it, but the investors got stupid. The investors got really stupid, and so did the rating agencies. And they started, when you're given 100% loans and no DOC loans to people who really can't qualify, that doesn't make sense. And that doesn't do the subprime borrower any good.
Right.
You know, they need to have something to, they actually have a chance of paying off.
No DOC loans means what, Dory?
No documents. I mean, you don't have to back up what you're saying.
Didn't even have to, no income verification, no job verification.
No.
No credit report verification.
And then what Bob says is right. You don't have an aligning of interest with the originator, so the originator is going to do everything he can to get that person into the loan. And if they have to fudge a little and push the limit, they wind up doing it.
Well, and this whole thing, John, it is just what you guys were saying. It's all fee-driven. If I'm a mortgage broker out here, I bring somebody in, I get my fee, I'm out of it. I don't care about the credit. If I'm a mortgage company, I get my fee, I sell it in the securitized market. I don't care about I'm supposed to be the one who cares about the credit. I'm supposed to underwrite. Don't do it. I sell it out here to a group that packages it and all these collateral debt obligations. It gets rated by Moody's or Fitch or Standard & Poor's or something, and they say it's okay, so they get their fees, right?
Right, but I want to address the question here a little bit. There's nothing wrong with the securitization and the structures. It gets back to the pig thing, though. If you got a pig credit, it can't change it. You know, you got to have good underlying collateral. Now that the investors have got to be smart enough to pick up on that.
Right. And what's happening now, and I have some friends in this business of checking mortgages. Let me give you a couple little stories, and you'll appreciate these stories. One story, there was a group in Las Vegas generating mortgage loans, and in this particular case, they found a young lady with good credit, and they said, we'll pay you $42,000 to let us use your name and your social security number to get this loan. So they got the loan, went through all the securitization package. They forgot to pay the woman the $42,000. So the fraudulent deal was they forgot to pay her the $42,000. The way they found the woman, the lender in this case, is that they were able to look at the records, and the woman had sued the mortgage company for not paying them the fraudulent fee. And that's how they figured out what the heck was going on. Just one example of the kind of fraud that's happening out there. And then I'm told that looking at all these things, there's up to 90% of all these loans that are going past due have deficiencies in the documentation, which means, correct me if I'm wrong, Dory, but that means the lender who actually originated this thing is going to eat it, assuming they're still in business. Yes or no?
Absolutely. But like John said, there's 167 major lenders out there that have gone broke and gone belly up. And so the only recourse is then back to the investors, and investors wind up losing. So out of that $553 billion we were talking about, you have estimates upwards of $200, $250 billion that may be bad that we won't even see hit the market all the way through 2009.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, go ahead, sir.
Dennis, I'm a lawyer, and I've actually litigated a few of these cases on behalf of debtors against mortgage companies. And I think the key point that needs to be mentioned is the incentive on behalf of the person putting the mortgage out was to have it as large as possible, because their fee is based on a percentage of the loan value. So if they get a mortgage for $100,000, they're going to get less of a fee than if they can talk the guy into signing for a mortgage for $150,000. Now, that fellow may not be able to afford payments on a mortgage for $150,000, while he could have afforded a $100,000 mortgage. And that's where I think the problem lies, is not with the debtor who's been signing for too much, though that is their responsibility. It's for the people who aren't part of the banks that this gentleman has emphasized, who are getting fees based on the total mortgage.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate that. And we got at least one lawyer up here, and the lawyers always want to blame it on somebody else. His guy who's hired him was too stupid to know what he was signing. What's that all about,
John? A lot
John?
Of people are signing things indicating that they're making more money than they really are, or they have certain assets.
And now, don't foreclose on my house. I might have lied on this credit application, but that's the problem.
I would agree with the questioner in the sense that you had people that are in the realtor business and also mortgage brokers who have no incentive other than to get a signature on that $200,000 and shoot it out because they're not ultimately responsible.
Exactly. Mike?
Yeah, I was just want to concur with this. I hate to be on the side of the guy evicting the widows and orphans, but the borrowers really do have some obligation here. One thing I think is going to be real important that Ben Bernanke mentioned in a big speech in May is that we need to have sort of better informed consumers here. The loan documents need to be real clear and say, if you take this adjustable rate mortgage, here's what could happen. I mean, we do that when we go have surgery. Why don't we have that kind of brutal disclosure when you borrow money?
Dory.
It's idealistic, and I agree with it, but it's not realistic. What's going to happen, you're talking about a $24 trillion market in housing, and it's a sacred cow in D.C., and now they're going to get involved, and it's going to be really interesting to see who they point the finger at.
Let me look at graphic number 5, and you can see, for those of us who've either borrowed money on real estate or refinanced lately, President Bush said he was going to clean up this thing and make it easier. I mean, I tell you, there's nobody I know who even reads the documents. There's a loan origination fee, an appraisal fee, there's a credit report, an inspection fee, a mortgage broker fee, a CLO, a collateralized loan obligation access fee, a tax-related services fee, a mortgage insurance premium, abstract or title search, title. Nobody, and they read all this stuff, and then you go to sign your closing. You sign the note, the deed of trust, all the other waivers, the right of rescission. John, I mean, you guys in the lawyer business have just made it too tough for any smart people to understand
well,
this stuff.
30 years ago, you could get a mortgage or a loan and have one or two pages. I think congressional intervention in the process has turned any folks that have been in refinance or purchasing a home, you've got 3 inches worth of documents that no one has time to read or really understand.
Yeah, okay. We just have a couple of seconds left. I'll start with you, Mike. What should that viewer do if they find themselves enmeshed in this?
Well, first of all, be honest. Don't try and hide your problems if you owe somebody money. You know, fess up and say, I can't pay. But I think everyone should take a lesson out of this. If something can't continue to go on forever, it won't.
Good point. Dory, what should they do?
Stay liquid.
Stay liquid. Yeah. What are you doing in the investment market? I mean, the big-time capital markets, you think we're going to get through this okay, or do we have more grief to come?
Well, I think we have more to come. Real estate market's going to take several years to work out. If you go to downtown Miami, there's 27 cranes still sticking up building condos. It's going to take a while to build this out, but the stock market ought to be okay because it's not as overvalued as it was previously.
We're out of time. Thanks, Bob. Thank you, John. Thank you, Dory. And thank you, Mike. And thank you. As someone who has been around the financial services industry for his entire life, I must say that this situation appalls me. The ineptness, the fraud, the poor public policy decisions, and the sheer lack of doing what's right have led to a difficult situation which only promises to get worse before it gets better. Now, I sincerely hope that we don't have an oppression because of real estate in the next 2 or 3 years, but if we do, remember that you heard it here first. Thanks for asking us in to talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.